Hi, I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm particularly grateful to be sober in San Diego. I practiced a lot. I don't know why they call it practicing. I was really good at it. But I drank a lot in San Diego, and if I look familiar to any of you, if I owe you an amends, I'd like to make it now. I hit my bottom here about 16 years ago. I wasn't then drinking, so I moved to Orange County, lowered my standards, and drank for 4 more years. But I love being sober in San Diego, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what happens to us here. I like the feeling that I have when I come into a room. When I come in here, something magical happens to me. And I can come in, doesn't matter what kind of a mood I'm in out there, doesn't matter what's going on out there at work or in my family life or if I had one in my relationship or anything else. It doesn't matter what's going on out there. Something happens when I come here and I sit in the middle of you and I hear chapter 5, and chapter 5 starts, rarely have we seen a person fail. And when I hear those words, it's like it brings me right back here, right into the here and now, right into the room with you, and I'm okay, and I know I'm okay for an hour and a half while I'm with you. And then in the time that I'm here listening to you share your experience, strength, and hope, something happens to me. So that when I go back out there, whatever it was that was going on at work or whatever it was that was going on in my family or whatever was going on out there somehow got different in the hour and a half that I was sitting here with you. And I love that feeling. I love the 12 steps of recovery. I like the way that they've changed my life, the things that they've done to me and for me, and it hasn't always been that way. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. I hated being sober. I didn't want to be sober. I was a little offended when I found out that if you come here, you don't drink. And that bothered me a lot. And I hated being sober. I had been sober one time before for 13 years, and I hated it. I hated every minute of it. And then I had my first drink, and life got wonderful for a little while. And then when I ended up here, I just thought I was going to hate it again, and I probably just hate it for the rest of my life. And when the pain got so great that I couldn't stand it anymore, being sober, I became willing to look at the 12 steps of recovery. And I wish I could tell you that happened to me right away, but it didn't. I often feel when I talk at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I should introduce myself and say, I'm Patty and I'm a pig. Because I drank, smoked, snorted, swallowed, shot, stuffed, crammed, anything that would make me feel different than how I felt. And it didn't matter to me what it was. I was one of those folks that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And it never mattered to me what it was. It didn't ever matter to me what it was. In fact, a friend of mine gave me this little pig for my birthday just to remind me. And after she gave it to me, because she heard me say that once at a meeting, I thought, well, from now on when I talk at AA meetings, I'm going to say, I'm Patty and I should drive a Mercedes. You know, I'm Patty and I should have a, you know, and see if it works all the time. But it worked with the pig. The funny thing about this pig is when I'm out doing what we do out in the world and like important things, like going to the grocery store and things like that, I'll be in line checking out, and the cashier will say, oh, what an interesting necklace you have. I've never seen anybody with a pig. And so I start to tell her why I have it on. And I start talking about incomprehensible demoralization and vomiting blood. And they don't want to hear it. I bet you when I do that, they don't check out half of my groceries. They just shoot them through. Get me out of this store. They just don't want to hear it at Alpha Beta. And I love the laughter. I love the laughter in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, it was the laughter that began to heal me. I came in here with walls 18 feet out protecting me. You see, I had grown up in an alcoholic family. I grew up with a lot of emotional and mental and physical violence. I just grew up a little dysfunctional. And I kept building all these little walls just to keep you out because I just didn't want to get hurt anymore. And I had like 18 feet of walls, and they worked really, really well. They kept you out. The thing that I never realized about those walls is they made me a prisoner inside. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And I came here and I sat for an awfully long time, and it was the laughter in the rooms that began to break through some of those walls. And when some of those walls got broken through enough, then the love of one alcoholic for another could come in and could start to change me. And that didn't happen for a while. I sat here for 8.5 months, and I didn't drink and I didn't use before I even caught the disease of alcoholism. For the first 8.5 months that I was here, I was not an alcoholic. I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I drank good. I'm a good drinker. I could start drinking at 6 in the morning, and I could go until I passed out. And you folks talked about having what's the first drink that got you drunk. And I thought, well, for Christ's sake, if I could only drink one drink and I'd be drunk, I'd want to quit too. I mean, what's the point in that? And you told me you were sick people, and I believed you. But it wasn't me. Alcohol was not a problem for me. Alcohol was a solution for me. Alcohol was the thing that made it okay for me to be out there. It was the thing that made it okay for me to go to school and to go to work and to go to the grocery store and to go to the laundromat. Alcohol was a solution for me. I didn't understand alcohol being a problem. And I had to not drink and not use for 8.5 months to get far enough away from my last drink to see what my relationship to alcohol had been. It took 8.5 months of not drinking and not using and sitting here with you to get far enough away to see that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And that, it says in the book, is the first step in recovery. And it was 8.5 months after I came here that I caught the disease of alcoholism. And I wish I could tell you that I started recovering then, but I didn't. I have never done anything in Alcoholics Anonymous till my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I become willing to look at the next one, the 12 steps of recovery. I had an opportunity today to... I have a son who's going to be 13 next week, and he used to be my best friend. Now that he's entering adolescence, I'm not so sure anymore. But he's grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's grown up with the love of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's grown up with you. You have taught him everything you know. He knows. You've taught him how to love. You've taught him how to care. You've taught him how to be understanding. You've taught him how to be compassionate. And I'm real grateful for that. You've also taught him how to con and how to manipulate and, you know, a few other things. But I'm real. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. So just in that one little area, I've been overpaid. But he got involved in Alateen when he was 12. And I think if any of you, this is just my opinion, doesn't say this in the book, but any of you that have children, I believe that Alateen is just an incredible place for them. And even though he's grown up here, he's neurotic like the rest of us. I mean, he sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 11 years and could never say anything. So now he's like an Alateen, and he can just rock his jaws as much as he wants to and have an opportunity to start to develop some of the stuff that we developed through the 12 steps of recovery. So the point of the story, if there is one, is there's an Alateen convention this weekend in Newark, California. I thought Newark was in New Jersey, but up by San Francisco, and his Alateen sponsor got the registration things and said she was going to drive the kids there. So I sent off the registration fee and figured everything was set. And then Wednesday night at his Alateen meeting, she said, "Oh, well, by the way, I'm not going. But I'll find another ride for you." And we waited for her to call. Well, we didn't wait patiently. Patrick called about 20 times and left messages. And he never got a hold of her yesterday. And this morning she called him and said she was really sorry, but she couldn't find anybody from our area who was driving up there. And you know, she just didn't know what else to do. So he was disappointed, a little natural disappointment. I was a little PO'd because I figured I'd just thrown $76 down the toilet, but I went off to work, and he called me about an hour and a half later and said that he called the bus station, and he could take a bus there, but he'd have to transfer in Los Angeles. And I just had this little about a 13-year-old transferring buses in Los Angeles. I have a little about a 38-year-old transferring buses in Los Angeles. So I didn't like that idea too much. And so then about a half hour later, he called me again, and he had found out about the trains. And the point is that you have taught him to be into action. You've taught him that, you know, okay, this came up and you're disappointed, but why get in the negative part of it? Why not get into the solution? So he's into the solution of trying to get himself to Newark. And finally, I came home and to take care of some stuff at home, and I called the airport or the travel agency. Anyway, make a long story short, I found out that if we could be in Los Angeles in 2 hours, that he could fly to San Jose, the Hilton would come pick him up in this little van and take him to the hotel, and then Sunday the van would take him back to the airport, and he could fly home. And fortunately, I have the kind of job where I'm able to take that time off just when I need it like that. So he threw God knows what into his suitcase. He's probably got 18 pairs of shorts and nothing else, but he packed his suitcase, and we got in the car, and we headed for Los Angeles. Well, from Dana Point to LAX, on a good day, is about an hour and 15 minutes. If there's traffic, forget about it. So we got up there. I paid for his, we made a reservation. I paid for his ticket. Not that I had the money, but Visa made a mistake in giving me a credit card not too long ago. So I paid for his ticket, got him to his gate, explained to him, when you come home Sunday, this is how you're going to do it. Look at this board and do these things, and asked him to call me from the hotel when he got there. And then I went back to work. And I was driving back to work, and I was thinking about it. 12 years ago, I would not have done that. My son spent the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them, on a pool table in a smoky, sleazy bar. That's where he spent the first 11 months of his life. My son is eternally grateful that I'm sober, because he would no longer fit in one of those plastic things. And I didn't like him. I didn't like you. I didn't like him. I didn't like myself. I didn't like anybody. I wouldn't have gone out of my way for anyone. And I was driving back and thinking, you can't get here from there. Absolutely no way to get to where I am today from where I was 12 years ago. It's absolutely impossible. And the only thing I know is the difference in me today than 12 years ago is that I have worked the 12 steps of recovery. And I try on a daily basis to apply the principles to my life the best I can. But it's the only thing I know that's different from 12 years ago and today, coupled with the small fact that I don't drink or use one day at a time. And that, for me, is the power of the 12 steps of recovery. The power for me is that I am able to do things today that I couldn't do before I worked the 12 steps. I'm able to be who I am today, and I could never be who I was before I worked the 12 steps of recovery. Who I am today is completely different than who I was before I worked the 12 steps of recovery. And it's an absolute miracle for me that those simple 12 things work as incredibly powerful in my life as they do. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I was at a beach just south of Oceanside. And I was with a group of girls, and I had a pint of vodka. I don't know where it came from to this day. I don't know where it came from, but I had it in my pillowcase. And when we got into the tent that night to go to bed, I took it out and I asked if anybody wanted any of it. And nobody wanted any of it. And the reason they told me they didn't want it is all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took the top off and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around and nothing had gotten different and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was the end of my social drinking. Never again. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. But I drank that, and I sat there in that tent, and everything was the same as it had been. And the only thing that got different was after about 15 minutes, I had to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I kind of shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in there and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move my eyelids. I didn't think I was breathing. I couldn't feel my heartbeat. And I was overcome with an absolute sense of fear. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse. And there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. So I later in my drinking, I discovered that two people can use the same toilet at the same time if the second person is very careful about what they're doing. But at 13, I didn't know that. So what I did was I got all the energy in my body that seemed to be anywhere. I got it all till it seemed to be in one central location. And when it seemed to be all gathered up, I just kind of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had this fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being the dive bomb, that I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to throw up. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I somehow managed to get to the tent. I fell in. I passed out. I came to the next day, and I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized that I had been sick all night long. I had hit the top of the tent, the sides of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch of it. And I didn't want to be in there either, so I got out. And that was my first drink, and I loved it. It was the most marvelous, wonderful, incredibly spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis for 13 years until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk. And I didn't always drink kinds of things that you would classify as beverages. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I drank a lot of mouthwash. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. And yet, when I came here, I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. When I came here, I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that at 13 years old, I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average, drinking alcoholically on a daily basis. I stayed and took classes for my master's degree because I'm one of those folks, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. So I stayed there and took classes, and when I had taken all the classes they had to offer, I left. And I was headed for Chico, California. I had a friend from high school who lived there, and I my degree is in journalism, so I write really good letters. And I had corresponded with this woman all through college and just let her know how incredibly well I was doing, and I would probably be editor of the Times, you know, any day now. And I write a really good letter, so she didn't have a clue. And she said to me, why don't you come up here when you finish school, why don't you come up here and you can kind of start, you know, your career up here. Well, nobody had asked me to come anywhere in a long time, so I was up for that. So I left San Diego and was headed for Chico, California, which is at the northern part of California. I had two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got 66 miles north of here at the first street off-ramp in Santa Ana, and I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. And I pulled off the freeway, and I don't know about you, but I have a sense. I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled off. In fact, I saw the Tango Room down here on Aragon. I mean, that looks like a place I would like to drink in. It was like that purple neon out in front, yeah. It's not an advertisement for the Tango Room. But I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke, and it had, and you'll only identify with this if you're a sleazy bar drinker. It had that smell of day-old smoke and urine kind of mixture. And somebody had thrown up at the front door, looked like weeks before that, and hadn't cleaned it up. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down, I ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got, 66 miles from where I started from. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I had put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. Alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got a job sometime later at a hospital in Mission Viejo, and I was on my way home from work late one night, and I don't know about here, but in southern Orange County, we don't have a lot of trees. So the ones we have, we protect with like little brick walls around them. And I was driving down the road toward the freeway, and to this day, I don't know how this happened. Somehow, that tree, brick wall and all, jumped right out in front of my car. And I hit it. I had a little Datsun B10 at the time, and it just kind of buckled up like an accordion. I turned the engine off, got out of the car. I had a lot of blood. I thought I had a bloody nose. I had a lot of blood. And I got out of the car and locked it because I have a record for car thieving. And I know that if you don't lock your car, now mind you, this car is about this big at the time. And I started walking back up to the hospital. Well, I have, since I've been sober, I have discovered that God has always been very gentle with me. I never knew that. But God has always been very gentle with me, because that night I walked up to the hospital thinking I had this bloody nose. I walked into the emergency room. The admitting clerk, by coincidence, was a friend of mine. And I walked in and I said, "Connie, can you help me?" And she turned around and looked and started to scream, which I don't think is very professional, but... They came running in from the emergency room and they took me in the back. Now, the shift that was on was about to go off, so they didn't want to start with me. And the shift that was coming on hadn't clocked in yet, so they didn't want to start with me. So this kind of laid me down in the back and let me wait there. Well, because this woman was a friend of mine, she came back to talk to me. And what had happened was, apparently I had screamed and then hit my chin and bit my tongue. So all this blood that I thought was coming from my nose was coming from my mouth. And she couldn't look at me, so she pulled the curtain around me. But she was sitting outside, and we were talking. And I stopped talking. And when I stopped talking, she knew something was wrong, and she looked in. And what had happened was, when they laid me down, this blood started going down my throat, and I was drowning on my own blood. Now, if this woman, by coincidence, hadn't been a friend of mine, I would have died on that table. The shift coming in would have come in. They'd have found me dead. They'd have written dead on arrival. They'd have done whatever they do with dead on arrivals. And I can tell you, I'd have been really pissed off. I wouldn't have liked it at all, but... They came, you know, she started screaming again, and I was out, so I didn't know till the next day what they had done, and I'm glad I didn't know. But they put 150 stitches in my tongue trying to save it. And once they sewed it up, it swelled, and I couldn't swallow my own saliva, so they couldn't let me go home. They had to admit me into the hospital, and they had IVs in me to give me liquids and to medication and whatever else. They had all these IVs in there, and as soon as they hooked me up, I unplugged myself. Now, I worked at that hospital. I knew that in the doctor's dying room, there was a full stock bar. So I unplugged my IVs, and I don't know why they charge you so much to stay in a hospital, and then they only give you the front of a gown. But in that little outfit, I left my room. I walked down the hallway into the lobby and into the doctor's dying room, and I got a bottle of booze. And I went back to my room. I rang for the nurse. I was very indignant that my IVs had fallen out. She hooked me back up. Now, I can't swallow my own saliva. She hooked me back up and left, and I took a tablespoon, and I took that bottle, and I poured a tablespoon of booze. I put it as far back in my throat as I could without gagging. I tipped it over, and I let it run down. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have the choice. I was there for 15 days, and every day I got up, I unplugged, I walked to the doctor's dining room, and I got another bottle of booze. And I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result of one more drunk driving assault charge. I had to come here to find out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And I'm one of those folks that when I go to jail, when I get out, I get the arrest report and I read it. I find out where I made my mistake so that I could practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And you see, I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I studied field sobriety tests a lot. I decided I had developed this driving problem. So, and I'm a bar drinker. I did all the things women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of things that men bar drinkers do. I was never real particular about my behavior. But if you're a bar drinker, you've got to get home. So I would walk home from the bar. And on those nights, I'd get arrested for drunken public assault. And it never occurred to me it had anything to do with drinking. It was you and they and them. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. And then one night, I did this thing that I thought was clever. I still think it's pretty clever. One night when they were locking up the bar, I just kind of hid out in the bar. And that night I got arrested for breaking and entering assault. And I never got it, that it had anything to do with alcohol. And so on my last drunk driving assault charge, the sheriff in Orange County has absolutely no sense of humor. I'm expert now at field sobriety tests. I get pulled over in Orange County one night, and I'm taking the field sobriety test, and I'm doing really well. And at the end of it, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before that, I had responded with, "Well, I can't even do that sober." Well, then I had just confessed, right? And they cuffed me and they took me in. So this last time, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, "Okay," and I turned around. So you guys think it was funny. He didn't think it was funny. He took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, there were real criminals in there. There were prostitutes in there. There were burglars in there. There were thieves in there. There were women in there who had been arrested for beating their husbands, which I don't think should be a crime, but they... apparently, they locked you up for it anyway. And I knew I didn't belong there. I knew I didn't belong there, so what I did was I tried to organize a prison break. And I explained this plan really carefully to the criminals, and it was pretty simple. We're going to bang our coffee cups on the bars. We're going to make a lot of noise. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm going to throw my arm out around the bars, get her around the neck, get her keys, and we're going to get out of there. And I explained it carefully and slowly to these women. And when I got done, one of them said to me something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. This woman looked at me and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" And I said, "Fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out of here." I was going like a mad woman on those bars. Now, there's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is it'll make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. When the bars ate them up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And a few hours later, they came to the cell and they called my name and they were releasing me on an OR. And I hadn't been released from jail on an OR in a very long time. And I knew they were making a mistake, but I wasn't going to be the one to tell them about it. And they took me to a telephone and they told me I could make one call. And I stood there for 5 minutes. I could not think of one person I could call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. I certainly couldn't call anybody in my family, and there was no one in my life who I considered a friend that I could call to come pick me up. And then the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head, and I called her with that alcoholic arrogance. I didn't ask her. I told her to come pick me up from Orange County Jail, and she did. And she took me back to where my car was, and as I was getting out of her car, she looked at me, and she said, "Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you, and I don't want to hear about you, and as far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist." And I thought, fine. I gave her one of these, and see, I've been raised all my life to know that if I needed something then, I better do it. That I couldn't depend on you or they or them. And if I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. And I didn't need you, and I didn't need her. And I reconfirmed that commitment that morning as she drove away. And I got in my car, and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went to the bar, and I told the guys how they had done it to me one more time. One more time, it was circumstances and conditions. One more time, it was you and they and them. One more time, it was a lot of things. Never once did it occur to me it had anything to do with my drinking. And I went to court on that drunk driving assault charge, and because of my past record, the judge was sentencing me to 5 to 10 years in jail. And I had no options. And my son was 8 months old at the time, and they were going to put him in a foster home because I was an unfit mother, and I was going to jail for 5 to 10 years. And in the middle of sentencing me, he did something that I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of it, he looked at me and the expression on his face changed and the tone of his voice got different. And he said, "I know this isn't going to work for you, but I'm going to give you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative, and part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you I rushed here, looked at the 12 steps of recovery. I knew they were the solution to my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. But that isn't my story. I drank for 3 more months. I didn't drink a greater quantity of alcohol because physically it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known before. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what AA was. I thought it was maybe something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners. And a lot of days it is. But the thing that was different about that day was that I didn't drink and I didn't use. You see, and I didn't plan it for myself that way. I never planned to go a day without drinking or using. It never even occurred to me. I don't identify with the part of Chapter 3 where it talks about the ways we tried to control our drinking. I never tried to control my drinking. I'm a good drinker. I would every once in a while try to control my behavior. But I never tried to control my drinking, and it never occurred to me to go a day without drinking. And yet on October 4th, 1975, I didn't drink. And that night I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because that was my experience, I know for me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that my sobriety is a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God, because I never planned it for myself. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say every once in a while, and since my first meeting, it hasn't been necessary for me to drink. I want to tell you that it has been incredibly necessary for me to drink a number of times. It has been excruciatingly necessary for me to drink a number of times since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle is that no matter how necessary it's been, I haven't had a drink and I haven't used a drug since October 4th, 1975. And I didn't plan it for myself that way. I never planned to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I planned to stay for the 15 months that I had my court card. And somebody asked me once why I even bothered, because it took me so long to even realize I belonged here. They said, why did you even bother? The program that I was in, there were a number of folks who drank right through the program, never let it interrupt their drinking for a minute. I had, for some reason, and I never heard it, I don't know where I made it up from, I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous had a bar patrol. And I figured that after these meetings, what you did is you banned off into little groups and you went out to the bars to check to see if anybody who had been at your meeting was in a bar. And I knew that if I drank, the AA bar patrol would find me. And I was going to do 10 years. And I was willing to go to any length to stay out of jail. You see, I've done jail. I know how to do jail. There's more drugs and alcohol inside the institution than there are some days on the street if you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any length. And I always was. And I knew that, but at the same time, at 26 years old, I knew, for some reason, I knew that if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I would become institutionalized for life. And I don't know why I knew it, but I knew it, and I was willing to go at any lengths to stay out of jail. And so I planned to stay for 15 months, and as soon as my court program was over, I'd go back and do what I knew how to do. And I'm eternally grateful that at 8.5 months, I caught the disease of alcoholism, and I knew I belonged here. When I was a little over a year sober, I was at the Canyon Club. I heard Bob say about that God put Frank in his life when he needed him. I have drugged newcomers to coffee that don't even want to go to coffee. I don't wait for God to put them in my life. I just drag them right out of the meeting when I need to share my experience, strength, and hope. When I need to remember real clearly what it used to be like, I just drag newcomers out. I don't care if they want to go or not. But it was a little after my first birthday. I was at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach, and there was a man that had been sober for about 20 days, and he was in the club, and he was drunk. And I talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I went to the bathroom, and when I came out, he was gone, and I asked somebody where he went, and they said that he left. And I went out to the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him if he was okay, and he said, yeah, I'm going to go home and sleep it off. He said, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. I was 27 years old, I was a little over a year sober, and I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. You see, my parents told me that they loved me, and they told me that I was being raised with love. Any more of their love and I'd have died. Their love was incredibly painful, and I knew as a very small child that if I loved you, I would have to hurt you, and if you loved me, you were going to hurt me. And I had made a commitment as a small child to never love another human being, and I hadn't. I had never said the words, I love you. And when I said them to that man that night, I didn't know what they meant. But I knew what it felt like, and it felt good. It wasn't that horribly painful thing I thought it was. And as he drove out of the parking lot, I started to cry, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And the line in Chapter 5 that says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to a simple program. That line went through my head, and I knew that if I was to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have to give myself completely to this program. And that night, I made a decision to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, my sobriety was a gift. My recovery is a choice, and I continue to make that choice on a daily basis. Step two for me was not difficult. I was raised Catholic. I'm still recovering from that, but I've been sober long enough now to know it wasn't always the Catholic Church. I have always had, and I still today have, a hearing problem. It isn't always what you say to me, it's how I hear it. An example of that that I like to share is when I was going to school here, I had a little 750 Yamaha. I couldn't afford to buy a car, so I bought this little scooter. And 750 Yamaha is pretty big for anyone, I think. But anyway, I'd cut around on this thing and go to school. And I'd get up in the morning, and I'd go to school, and then I would go to work, and then I would go to the bar and drink. And when the bar closed at 2, I would shoot home. And we lived in a four-story apartment building, and the garages were underneath the first apartment. And if you know anything about motorcycles, before you turn them off, you have to rev them up to blow all that stuff out of the pipes. So I would get home at 2:30, quarter to 3 in the morning, go into the garage, rev it up, turn it off, and go up to the fourth floor to go to, you know, to my apartment. And one morning my roommate said to me, she said, "You know, when you come home, I can hear that motorcycle up here on the fourth floor. Can you imagine what it sounds like to the people who live right above the garages?" And that's what she said to me. And I went off to school, and I went to work, and I went to the bar. And that morning coming home, I remembered what she said to me, and I driving in, and instead of going into the garage, I rode that motorcycle up four flights of stairs, crashed through our front door, onto the living room carpet, revved it up, turned it off, and went to bed. That isn't what she said to me. That's how I heard it. I want to tell you, that thing was a real son of a bitch getting down in the morning. So it isn't always what you say, it's how I hear it. But what I heard the nun say, that I was going to burn for just as long if I thought it as I was for if I did it. Now, I have always been a kind of into action person. And I figure if I'm going to burn for thinking it, I'm going to get some enjoyment out of doing it. So I have done a lot of things that I didn't even want to do. But I thought it, so I did it. And what I came to believe in step two was I came to believe there would come a day when I could have a thought and not have to take an action on it. And I'm happy to tell you that that's happened. I'm an alcoholic. I will always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while I have a thought that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, what I do is I clap, I say thank you for your participation, and I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. And I don't have to take an action on it. And a lot of other things, I don't have to take actions on. I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that it isn't what I think. It isn't what my motive is. It's what my action is. And as long as my actions are right, it doesn't matter. You don't get locked up for what you think, thank God. I hear people talking about how they don't think. But I'm so recovered, I don't think anymore. I think all the time. I'm up here sharing with you, I'm thinking about something different. You know, I mean, I think all the time. I am grateful that God didn't put us on this planet with, like, loudspeakers in our head so that everything we thought came projecting out of this loudspeaker. I would be in serious trouble. I think all the time. I don't have to take actions on most of what I'm thinking today. And that's what I came to believe would happen in step two, that I would be restored to that kind of sanity. I hear people in AA talk a lot about having difficulty with step three. I had no difficulty with step three. When the pain was so great, my back was against the wall, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I looked at step three and saw that it said made a decision. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm a great decision maker. I must make 1,000 decisions a day. Now, I don't have any trouble making decisions. What I sometimes have difficulty with is taking an action to implement the decision. That sometimes gives me some trouble, but I have no problems making a decision. And then it occurred to me that for 13 years on a daily basis, I had turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol and drugs. I have turned my will and my life over to the care of people even less qualified than myself a number of times. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of employers. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of any number of things. When the pain was so great, I had no other choice. It was a simple matter to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And then I looked at step four. Now, I'm a journalism major. I believed when I read step four that step four was for those of you who didn't have any creative writing skills. Those of you who hadn't done any writing for a while probably needed to write an inventory just to kind of brush up on your creative writing skills. I certainly didn't have to do it. And I didn't. I didn't do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And then something happened to me. I would come into a meeting in pain. I would sit in the middle of you. I would listen to you share your experience, strength, and hope. I knew I was different. I knew I was unique. I knew there was no point in me sharing with you because you weren't going to understand anyway. I sat in the middle of you, and I was isolated and alone. And I walked out in more pain than I had come in with. And I was coming to a meeting every night. So the next night I would come back in pain and sit in the middle of you and know that I was different, know there was no sense sharing with you, you weren't going to understand, and I would leave in more pain than I had come in with. And I did that night after night after night until the pain was so great that sitting in the middle of you, I knew that I was going to have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous because I couldn't stand the pain that I was in anymore. And somebody suggested that maybe before I leave, I try writing the fourth step. So I went home that night and I wrote my inventory. I didn't write down anything I didn't already know. Everything I wrote down, I already knew about myself. No secrets came flying out of my pen. Everything I wrote, I already knew. And the thing that happened to me is what it says in the book. I felt a part of. I knew I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I wasn't any different. I knew I wasn't unique. I knew my problems weren't special. And I could sit in the middle of you and know that I belonged here. And then I looked at step five and I thought it was cute. I thought step five was for those of you who weren't raised Catholic. Those of us who are raised Catholic know about confession and we know it doesn't work. And I thought sharing all this stuff with somebody else was to give the rest of you the experience that it really doesn't do much good. Also, when I was growing up, we had to go to confession every Saturday. Now, I was just a little kid. I wasn't into any big sinning yet. And every Saturday, I'd have to go to confession, and I'd tell the priest the same boring sins week after week after week. I knew he was bored with it. I was bored with it. So one day when I was 12, I did this thing that I like to call creative confession. I got some magazines and books. I studied. I took notes. I wrote things down. My whole intent was just to put a spark in that man's afternoon. And that Saturday, I went off to church with my confession under my arm, and I went in and I did my creative confession. I have to tell you, it worked really well. The priest was breathing hard by the time I was done. He had said my God a number of times. And I came out of there and I really felt good. Now, I have to tell you, I'm 38. I still have not done some of the things I told that priest I did when I was 12. I have done a few in the last year, and I'm really sorry I've waited so long. But I really felt good because I had done something for another human being, and I felt good all the way till the next day. And the next day after Mass, the priest came up and he told my father the things I had told him in the confessional. And my father took me home and he beat me, and I understood that. That meant that he loved me. But I made a decision that day that I would never trust another human being. If I told you anything about me, you were going to use it against me. And I became what I like to call pathologically private. I never told you anything about me, and pretty soon I couldn't even tell me anything about me. And so with that experience, you can imagine how excited I was when I saw step five. I just thought, you bet I'm going to do that. So I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car, because I didn't want anybody to find it. I lived alone, but I didn't want anybody to find my fourth step. So I put it in the trunk of my car, and I drove around with a perpetual impending sense of doom. And my fear was I was going to get rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk was going to fly open, and my fourth step would be everywhere. Rather than do a fifth step, I chose to drive around with that kind of fear for an awfully long time. And then I was in Los Angeles one night visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking, and it suddenly occurred to me that while we were talking that I was doing my fifth step. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And I would not have picked this woman to do a fifth step with. My program was not terrific. Hers was worse than mine. She had 2 weeks less sobriety than I did. And I would not have picked her to do my fifth step with. But because it happened that way, you know, I know for me that God gave me the person that I needed to have in order to do my fifth step. And I went down and I got it and I came back and I did my fifth step with her. And when I got done, she looked at me and she said, Patty, she said, one day the things that you think are your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things that you think are your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, terrific. I have just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last wingnut. I have to tell you that the things that I have always thought were my greatest assets in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest liabilities. And the things that I thought were my greatest liabilities become my greatest assets here. And I don't know how that happened. An example that I like to share about that is I was... we have a women's meeting in Laguna Beach for women who hate women's meetings, and it's really quite popular. And I was at that meeting one night, and a woman who had a little more time than I did came up to me after the meeting and asked me if she could come home with me because she was going to kill herself, and she didn't want her husband and daughter to find her. Well, I had learned never to say no to an AA request, so I said, yeah, you can come home with me. Now, I have never been suicidal. I don't understand suicide. I'm one of those folks that has a huge ego. I cannot figure out what the world would do without me. So I don't understand suicide, but we walked into my house, and the first thing she did was open the refrigerator. She said, well, you don't have much food here. And I thought, well, what do you care? You're going to kill yourself. And then she opened the cupboard and she said, well, this is even worse. She said, this will never do. We have to go to the grocery store. That was about 5 years sober. I can't tell this woman that I can't do the grocery store. When I go to the grocery store, something happens to me. I can either do fresh fruits and vegetables or meat, depending on what door I go in. And I do one aisle, and then something happens to me, and I have to get out of there. And I can't do the grocery store. I do Stop and Go in 7-Eleven really well, but I don't do the grocery store. And I couldn't tell her that, so we went to Alpha Beta. I did white-knuckle grocery store shopping. I held on to that cart so tight. We went up and down every aisle. She threw things. I caught them in the basket, and we checked out. We got outside, and we walked outside. And this may not be a big deal to anyone in this room, but we walked outside, and I had one more freedom. I can do the grocery store today. And because she took my hand and walked with me, she never killed herself, and we're both alive and very sober tonight. And what I learned from that experience was that whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. Whenever I do anything alone, I shortchange myself. Whenever I do anything alone, I shortchange myself. See, I have always been an incredibly strong woman. What happens when you're a strong woman, and I suppose it happens if you're a strong man, I've just never met one. You know, you stand up here and share and just God's message just comes out. So being strong is very difficult for me to ask for help. Whenever I try to do anything alone, I shortchange myself. So that thing that was a strength becomes a liability for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I got home from doing my fifth step, and I looked at steps 6 and 7, and I did them by mistake. I didn't mean to do them. I had no intention of going any further than that. But I started reading the book. And the book, every newcomer will tell you that the book is very poorly written. I mean, it's really badly written. But that part right around steps 6 and 7 gets real poetic, and it's very short. And I started reading it, and it's just this little paragraph here, and then these two little paragraphs over here. And I got hooked into it. And I started to read it, and before I realized what I was reading, I was in the middle of the 7-step prayer. When I realized what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading the prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And for me, that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, is we have an opportunity to walk away from... The best I can describe myself, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's the best I can describe myself. And when I finished reading that prayer, I walked away from that person. I never have to go back and be that person again one day at a time as long as I continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. If that hasn't happened for you yet, please stay with us long enough. Please stay here until that happens for you. Steps 8 and 9 for me, I already had my list from my 4th step, and I'm an arrogant alcoholic. I looked at my list and I very arrogantly said, okay, God, if you want me to make amends to these fools, you put them in my life because I am not going looking for them. I want to tell you, people started showing up this quick. I had people in my face that I had forgotten to put on the list. I mean, they were coming from God knows where for their amends, you know, and I started making my amends. I had 2 amends to make that could have put me in jail for a very long time. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail. It's all I wanted out of this deal. And I had 2 amends to make that it could have put me in jail for a very long time. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed to the part of the book where it says, we don't have to make the amends if another person will be harmed. And my son was living with me, and I was a single parent. And they explained to me how if I went to jail, my son would be hurt or would suffer. And you see, when I came here, I was single and self-supporting through my own contributions. Through my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that if I had to go to jail, that one of you would take my son, and you would keep him, and you would love him. Because this is where he learned how to love. He didn't learn it from me, he learned it from you. And I knew that one of you would take him, and if I had to go to jail, that he'd be all right. And you see, I'm the only one who lives with my gut. I'm the only one who lives inside of here. I'm the only one who knows the pain in here. And I knew that in order to be free, I needed to go make those amends. And I went and made them. And I can't tell you how it happened, because it's absolutely impossible. But I went and made both of those amends, and I didn't have to do a single day in jail. And that's absolutely impossible. And when I finished making that second amend, I knew freedom for the first time in my whole life. When I finished making that first amend for the first time in my whole life, my feet were on the ground, and I could look eyeball to eyeball with every other human being. for the first time in my life, you know, it has never been enough and it has never been the right kind for me. I always thought if I had that job and that car and that house, I'd be all right. And I would get that stuff and it wasn't enough and it wasn't the right kind. And I needed that job, I needed that house, I needed that relationship. And I would get those things and it was never enough and it was never the right kind. I'm the kind of person I can use a year's supply of anything in 2 weeks. When I finished making those amends for the first time in my life was enough. And it was exactly the right kind. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want more. Greed was always a liability for me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, greed becomes an asset. Because I come here and I look in your eyes. And I see that there's more available. And I don't want to shortchange myself anymore, so I come back. And then I look in your eyes and I see there's more available, so I come back. And I come back. And I come back. And that greed that was always a liability becomes an asset. And it keeps bringing me back to Alcoholics Anonymous. For the first time in my life after I'd made those amends, my relationship with you was right. And because my relationship with you was right, my relationship with God was right. And for the first time in my life, my relationship with me was right. And if I hadn't made those amends, I'd have shortchanged myself. If I hadn't made those amends, if fear had kept me from making those amends, if any of the other things would have kept me from making those amends, I wouldn't have ever had an opportunity to feel the way I feel tonight. And I would have continued to shortchange myself. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are gifts that you've given me. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are gifts that you've given me that allow me the privilege of coming back here night after night and listening to you share. Step 10 for me, I'm a big wuss anymore. I can't stand pain. I hear people talk about at the end of their day, they review their day, and if they've hurt anybody, I can't wait till the end of the day. I don't have the pain threshold anymore to wait till the end of the day. If I hurt somebody, if I offend somebody, I have to make the amends right now. I can't wait till the end of the day to do it. And it seems to me that living my life that way, I don't have to go back into that slimy, dark pit of incomprehensible demoralization. I don't have to go back to that place of despair. And it's a simple matter of living my life that way. Step 11 for me, I'm a real simple person. I've always been very simple. My prayer in the morning is very simply, "Thy will be done." And I'm so naive that I believe after I say that prayer that the rest of my day is God's business. My job is to suit up and to not drink and to show up. That's my job. The rest of it is God's business. I use meditation for medical reasons, and I'm real grateful that you gave me that step. I don't believe I would be here today if it wasn't for the meditation that I do. Step 12 for me, I hate 12-step calls. I don't know about anybody in this room, but I hate 12-step calls. Orange County Central Office, 99% of the time I sleep alone. Just in case anybody wants to feel sorry for me. Orange County Central Office somehow knows when I have somebody spending the night. Because those are the nights that at 2:30 in the morning my phone rings. And I think, why don't they want to get sober at noon? You know, why didn't they want to get sober last night? You know, and I answer the phone, and I hate it. I have to get out of my bed, and it's always cold. And I bitch and I moan, and I call one of the women that I sponsor, generally one who has just recently got into a relationship, because I figure if I have to suffer, she might as well, too. And I go out to the car, and I moan, and I complain because it's cold, and I drive over, and I pick her up, and I bitch all the way over to wherever we're going. And I hate it. I hate 12-step calls. And then I get out of the car, and I walk up to the house, and I bang on the door, and I absolutely hate every minute of it until the door opens and I see the eyes and I see the desperation and I see the loneliness and I see the incomprehensible demoralization. I see the fear and I see all the stuff that I saw in my own eyes when I came here. And I look into the eyes and I know one more time that it's the greatest gift that you've ever given me is to allow me to share my experience, strength, and hope with another alcoholic. I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took a woman hostage one time to get her sober. Took her to about 500 meetings in 4 days. I've walked in on somebody drunk with a loaded gun in the dark. I charged one time for a 12-step call. There was a woman in the town not too far from here where my mother lives, and I was visiting my mother, and I know some of the AA people there. And I was at my mother's one Sunday, and this woman called me, and she had this 12-step call at this woman who has apparently been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 15 years and never can stay sober. And And she called and asked me if I wanted to go on the 12-step call, so I did. And, I mean, this lady lived, and this house absolutely fascinated me. It took half a tank of gas to get from the street up the driveway to the house. We knocked on the door. We go in. It was like that commercial for, I think, I don't know if it was Raleigh Hills or somewhere, where, I don't know who it was, comes down the spiral staircase in this, like, flimsy night sleeping thing, which I think are very impractical. You don't stay very warm in them, but I think I was wheeling down the stairwell, and I told this other woman to go into the kitchen and get some coffee, and the woman whose house we were at, she and I sat down, and I said, you know, the reason you can't stay sober is because the people here will not tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. If that's the reason you can't stay sober, I said, no, I don't have the power to just give you the secret, but for $100. So she took $100 out of her pocket. I thought, shit, I should have asked for more. And she gave me the $100, and I told her, I said, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And about then, the other woman came out with the coffee, and I stood up and I said, well, we don't need to stay here anymore, and we walked out. And when that lady took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her back her $100. And never once during that year did she ever tell anybody that I charged her for the coffee. And I just talked to her a couple of days ago, and she's still sober and very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've slept with newcomers, and I'll probably do it again. I've gone into AA meetings and taken all of your inventories. Not only that, but I share them with other people. I have probably done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the thing that I have done right is that no matter what, I haven't drank and I haven't used. And I don't know how that's possible for somebody like me. That's absolutely impossible for a pig to go for 12 years without drinking or using. I'm grateful that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I'm grateful that it works the way that it does. You see, I know that it takes a lot of courage to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It takes a lot of courage to stay here and to go through the things that we go through. Cowards drink and use. I know because I did that for 13 years. Cowards drink and cowards use. It takes a lot of courage, and it takes a lot of hard work to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're new or relatively new, I can guarantee you from my experience that it's worth it. My life is full today. I have never had it so good. And if I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. All I came here for was to stay out of jail. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. I have people in my life today who I love. And even better than that, I can allow you to love me. I don't have to be afraid anymore of being hurt. That doesn't mean I don't get hurt, but I don't have to shortchange myself. I don't have to hold back because of the power of the 12 steps. I have the ability to risk. I have an ability to be vulnerable. I have an ability to share with you who I am and what I am. And I could never do that before. I believe for me that it's the 12 steps to recovery that have given me the power to live my life to the fullest, to go through a day without having to shortchange myself, to make myself available for service for God and my fellows. I'm a selfish, self-centered. I don't want to do anything for you. And today I'm not only able to, but I'm willing to. And not only willing to, but the action follows, and I do it. And I look at my, every once in a while, I kind of go, what's wrong with you? That isn't who you are. And quickly, I had to go to a business meeting in Visalia last week, and I've never been up in that area, so I stayed overnight, and I went into Sequoia the next day. And Sequoia is closed for the winter, except for the trees, if anybody's interested in going up there. But it was like me and God, and we had a great time. We just really had fun. And then coming back out, I had a choice. I could either go to Fresno, or I could go this way. And, of course, I'd left my maps at home. I had several maps, but they were at home, so I didn't know where this way went, but I knew I didn't want to go to Fresno. So I went down this road. Well, this road, it was like hairpin turns. You couldn't sightsee. I've got both hands on the wheel, and getting down this road. And, God, I finally get to civilization. There's like this market as big as a stage. And I went in and I asked the guy if there's any place soon that I could get something to eat. And he said, yeah, 7.2 miles on the right. So I went 7.2 miles on the right, and there it was. And this town had 126 people in it, and it was a saloon. And so I went into the saloon, and they served breakfast, lunch, and dinner there. So I ordered what I wanted, and I was eating, and the Budweiser delivery truck came. Now, not that I paid attention, but he brought in 57 cases of beer. And he finally gets done, and he leaves, and I said to the woman there, I said, how often does he come here? Well, he only comes every other week. And it's a bar. They had hard alcohol there, too, and I would guess the other beer companies deliver there. I am so naive. Not only was it my thought, but I embarrassed myself and said it to this woman. I looked at her and I said, people come here and drink, and then they drive on that road that I just came down? And I thought, what a stupid thing to say. I mean, I always drove better when I drank roads, straightened out, you know. And of course they go there and drink, and then they drive up that road. It's probably easier. And I realized, for me, my recovery. You see, I know whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm drinking it, whether I'm fighting it in you drinking it, whether I have any big crusade going on, when I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Through recovery, I have become so naive that I ask, you mean people drink and then they drive on that road that I drove on? And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that that's happened in my life. I'm grateful I don't have to do battle anymore. I don't have to fight anymore. It's about being powerless, and it's about giving up. And in doing that, I have more freedom than I have ever had in my entire life. And I didn't come here for that. I only came here to stay out of jail. When I was 4 days sober, an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my relationships would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better, my family life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. I always like to give the newcomer a little hope. But it's all gotten different. And you see, if I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. My life is completely different than it was the day I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. And if I'd had it my way, I'd shortchanged myself over and over and over and over again. Dick died when I was 2 years sober, and I got real pissed off about it. And then I realized it probably impacted him a lot more than it did me. And I made a commitment that if I ever had an opportunity to share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would carry the message that he carried to me. So in closing, I'm going to tell you the two things that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt. The first thing is what Dick told me when I was 4 days sober. If you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And the other thing I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, because it too has been my experience, is the line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.